7 a.m. meeting. My name is Mike Boatwright. I'm a grateful recovering alcoholic. Welcome to the Monday night Blue Chip Speakers meeting at the NABA Club, where a member of Alcoholics Anonymous with 1 year or more of sobriety tells his or her story. Kathleen is going to introduce our speaker tonight.
I'm Kathleen. I'm an alcoholic. Hey, everybody. I've been instructed to read some stuff here. So this reading is based on a passage from page 29 of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. Each individual in our personal stories describes in their own language and from their own point of view the way they established their relationship with God. These give a fair cross-section of our membership and clear-cut idea of what has happened in their lives. We hope no one will consider these self-revealing accounts in bad taste. Our hope is that many alcoholic men and women in our room tonight and listening later on AABlueChipSpeakers.org desperately in need will hear our speaker, and we believe that it is only by fully disclosing ourselves and our problems that any of us shall be persuaded to say, yes, I am one of them too, and I must have this thing. And I'm going to introduce the speaker, and tonight's speaker is Ken, and he is, and I came down from the mountain in Dahlonega. So we are the Dahlonega people, and I love to hear Ken talk about his finding God. And I've known Ken only for a couple of years, but we are very close, and what I can tell you about him is he is like the same dude every day. He shows up as the same dude every day. And he means what he says what he means, and he truly walks his talk. I love him, and here he is.
Hello, I'm Ken. I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Ken.
For sure. And as I heard the thunder and the storm, I thought, well, maybe we'll get the power out and we'll have a short meeting, you know, that'll be good. So, but we're still here. My sobriety date is December the 1st in 93. I've been sober longer than I drank, and I hope my story can reflect that. You know, my story only goes up to when I sobered up, and then the rest is about my journey, you know. And my story is all through the Big Book. I drank too much. I spent my money on everything except what I should have spent it on. I lied. I cheated. I stole. I threw up on myself. I pissed in the bed. I was remembering today. I remember one time I came to out of a blackout, and I'm standing in my closet pissing in my shoes. I'm like, what the hell? You know, I had a bathroom right there, you know. So that's why I'm here. You know, I was thinking the other day because there was a motorcycle wreck, and, you know, killed this guy, and I think he was right the same age. I had a cousin, and I was about 6 months sober, went to a family reunion, and my cousins that were around our age, my family was real religious, you know, and so alcohol was taboo, so all the drinkers had gone out in the woods, you know, at this campground and were drinking, and they came out of the woods where I was sitting at the cabin. And I had a little baby son at the time. I was sitting outside the cabin reading my 12 and 12 Big Book something. And they come out, hey man, what's up? You know, drunk talking stuff. And they said, Jeff, my cousin, he said, what is that? That's some of that AA shit. I said, yeah. He goes, is it worth it? I said, so far, you know. Well, about 10 years ago, he died in a motorcycle wreck. He was drunk. Killed his girlfriend too while he was at it. So, you know, I'm glad it was working for me, and I wish it would have worked for him, you know. But, you know, I don't have a lot of stuff in my story. I've been sober a long time, and I've heard a lot of really good stories, and I'm not nearly as bad as some. I'm better than others, but it is my story. I don't care to talk about my family much because I tried to leave them out of my life anyway, you know, except when I needed something. Then I'd call and cry, you know, oh, I'm so sorry, you know, and all this stuff. So, but I was just a happy-go-lucky drunk and, you know, kind of worked, kind of drank. ruined relationships, got kicked out of apartments, wrecked cars, went to jail, and I never spent more than a night in jail. I had two DUIs, so that's really not all that bad. I remember I was thinking today about my last DUI, and I'd gone to work on a Saturday, drank, got off work, drank, got home. I was by myself. My wife at the time had gone off for the weekend or something, so I go home, and, well, you know, we get bored. We're restless, irritable, and discontented unless we can feel that ease and comfort with a few drinks. Well, I'd already had a few, but the restless and irritability was coming back, so I needed a few more. So I get in my truck, and I leave the apartment, and I'm driving, I don't know, a couple miles down the road. I'm like, oh, shit, my wallet. So I turn around, I'm coming back to the apartment. I'm like, well, maybe that's a sign I shouldn't go out drinking. Nah, that's all right. Well, I go out drinking, you know. About 4 hours later, the blue lights are behind me, you know. And all I think is, man, I'm glad he didn't catch me last night. I was really drunk then, you know, like it would matter, you know. So anyway, just kind of puttering along in life, you know. I don't know. But anyway, what got me, you know, when you try to walk on the edge, you know, living the light in the dark, you know, it doesn't take much to come along and push you over. And the thing that pushed me over was the death of my first son. And so I, you know, it was a Friday, and I was at work, got off work, went in the bar, drank, and got home. They called me, said, you need to get to the hospital. Your son's in the hospital. He was 22 months old. And he wasn't sick or anything, you know. So I go, and, you know, they said, well, he's dead. You know, he died, and that was it. You know, I mean, I can remember to this day. You know, and that was October the 4th of 91, and it was a Friday. I remember it clearly, and I remember friends started hearing about the news. You know, and I had a friend came to the house. He said, "Man, what can I do? What can I do?" I said, "Well, I don't have any beer." He said, "How much you need?" I said, "How much can you get?" You know, and I just drank. I drank and I drank. And I used to do hard drugs. I hadn't done any in a while. And within 3 months of him dying, I was into the dry goods along with all the wet goods. And so I was going down fast. And my wife at the time, his mom, you know, she wasn't putting up with that shit. You know, so it wasn't less than a year she was gone. And within a year of that, I had me a new wife. And she had a little girl who was about the same age as my son who had died. And so, you know, I just kind of try to move on through life, you know. And so we were married, and I remember, you know, I'd already been in a lot of trouble with my family. You know, you asshole alcoholic, you this alcoholic, you that. You know, I'd already been called all the names and threatened and all the things that happened to us. And but she sat, I was sitting in my little easy chair, and she sat down beside me, and she looked up at me, and she said, "I hate seeing you kill yourself this way." And, you know, I was good at when I was confronted, you know, to get angry back. You know, but I mean, it's kind of hard to get angry back when somebody's just looking at you, you know, and got tears in their eyes and stuff, and that's all they got to say is, you know, "I hate seeing you kill yourself this way." It's like, you know, and about a week later, we were in a fight or something. She goes, "Well, you need to go to AA." And nobody ever said that. My mom, you know, aunts, uncles, all these people who saw me killing myself, nobody ever said, "Can't go to AA." You know, they didn't say go to treatment. They just told me to go away, basically. So she said, "You need to go to AA." I'm like, "Well, if I got to go, you got to go." And she goes, "Okay." Because I didn't know anything about Alcoholics Anonymous, and I didn't know they had an Al-Anon, but she did. And I said, "Well, if I got to go, you got to go." She goes, "No problem. I'll go to Al-Anon." I said, "Oh, shit." And I said, "Well, I'll have to find one." She goes, "I did. It's right down the road." And I lived in this was in Lewisville, Texas, and I'd lived there for about 5-6 years. Had my house for about 5 or 6 years, and the AA group was 2 miles down the road. But I never went that way because there wasn't a liquor store that way. The liquor store was the other way. So I never went down there. I wouldn't have noticed anyway. So I said, "Well, whatever, you know." And so sure enough, we go to an AA meeting. It's on a Friday night, and it's a speaker meeting, and there's a guy named Rich, and he's telling his story, and man, he is jacked up, man. He talked out of the side. He's kind of like a stroke victim or something. You know, he talked out of the side of his mouth, and his arm was kind of twisted, and he kind of walked with the limp, and he was telling his story, and the reason he had that affliction was he was like vice president of a big food conglomerate or something, and he had lost his job through drinking, and the only job he could get was a stock boy at a warehouse, and a big can, one of the big number whatever cans that food come in, fell and hit him in the head, and that caused, you know, all the brain damage and stuff. But he was sober, and I was thinking about him today, and his wife was a bona fide alcoholic, and they stayed married, and he got sober, and she never did, and he's dead now. He was the first person to tell me he was going to be my sponsor. All right. But he didn't last long. So anyway, I started going to AA, and I really didn't want to quit drinking. You know, I just didn't want to get in trouble. You know, I didn't want the results of drinking too much. You know, I just wanted to drink too much without the results. And so I go to AA, and I went almost every day. And for about 9 months, in February, about 9 months, I went to AA almost every day. Sometimes I went 2 a day, but I never got more than 2 weeks. I just couldn't get it. You know, I could maybe go 1 weekend, but that next weekend roll up, man. You know, boy got a drink. And I did find out it's better to drink before a meeting than after. You know, because at least if you drink before, you got that little window of elation, you know, of getting away with it. You know, because you try to drink after a meeting, and there's no joy, you know, as you just drink, you know, and you cry. So, you know, at least if I drink before, you know, I had the little window of happiness. And that was enough. That's all I needed, was that chance. So I kind of moved along like that for about 8-9 months. And this is when the journey begins. On October the 3rd of 93, 2-year anniversary of my son's death, I went to a meeting, and I was crying. You know, my son died 2 years ago today, and I'm so sad. You know, I shouldn't drink, and I can't get sober, and I was crying. And I did the same thing I always did, is I'd bring up some of my stuff, and then I'd get up and leave. And I'd go out and get coffee, and then I'd, like, try to hear if anybody was going to pick up on my topic. You know, was I going to, you know, really motivate this group to do that, you know? So I got up, you know, I brought it all up, cried and everything. I went up and went in the coffee area, and I was in there, and I was pouring my coffee, and Rich came up behind me. He said, "Ken, why not you?" And I'm like, "What?" He goes, "Why not you? Why can't bad shit happen to you?" You know, he said, "You don't think all these people in this room have their same demons to fry? You know, they don't all have their own stuff, but they don't drink. You know, why can't you?" Man, pissed me off. You know, pissed me off. "You don't understand." So anyway, I went back in the meeting, and I sat there with my coffee cup, and I sat right across from Rich, and I gave him my biggest eat shit look I could give him. I just stared at him. Death ray eyes, the whole meeting, man. I just sat there looking at him, man. And he didn't care, you know. So anyway, after the meeting, you know, I was pondering on this, and I was going to bed, and I thought, you know, God, I'll just never get any better until I get through this. And I'd always just wanted to get over it, you know. And I don't know why, and I still remember that I asked to get through it. And I drifted off to sleep, got up the next morning, went to work. I worked for a big corporate manufacturing company and had a lot of people work for me. And there was some machinery down, and we were, you know, I was like their supervisor, and I was telling them how to fix the machines. It was 11-something in the morning. And, I mean, I woke up and just nothing, you know. I just went on about my business. And then at this 11 whatever time, we're inside the machine, and all of a sudden it just came to me. And I said, "Oh crap, y'all do this, and I just left. And I went to the back of the plant where there was, you know, just scrap metal and stuff. Nobody was back there. Because when I was little, about 3 or 4, my dad died. And so, you know, I always, you know, had this imaginary what it'd be like to have a dad kind of thing. And, you know, having an imaginary dad is probably just as bad as having a bad dad, you know, because we just always would have been better if, you know. And so, anyway, my whole life I dreamed that my dad was around, you know. And then my grandfather died, and then I dreamed that he was around. And then when my son died, then I dreamed all three of them were around. And they were all, it was always the same scenario. And what I realized was that night, I dreamt my normal dream was that I would dream that they were with me, all three of them, my son, my grandfather, and my dad. And they would be together in under a spotlight, and there was a low hum, murmur going on. And as the light grew and the murmur got loud, we were surrounded by people, family, friends, familiar faces. It was like an arena. And we're standing in the middle, and all these people, this murmur just grew louder and louder and louder. And then it was finally audible, and it was, they're not real, they're not real. And then all of a sudden it would just stop, and it would come just to a spotlight with me and a ball at my feet. And I had this dream almost every night. It was one of the reasons I told myself I had to dream, you know, because you just can't go to sleep knowing you're going to dream that shit. You need to pass out, you know. So, that night, on October the 3rd of 93, I dreamt that I was walking through a thicket, like a bamboo thicket, and I just came into a clearing, and in that clearing was three tombstones. There was my father, my grandfather, and my son. And I looked at them, and I nodded, and I just walked on. And to this day, I've never had that dream again. And that was God saying hello. You know, my sobriety date is December the 1st of 93, so I still got a little drinking to do. You know, yay. So, you know, God can touch you, but he ain't going to make me do nothing I don't want to do. I can guarantee you that. And so I just kind of muddled on through for a few weeks. I mean, that was very enlightening. You know, it really scared me that, you know, there might really be a God, because I've been going to meetings for 9 months. They talked about it. It's in the steps, you know, and I... So on November the 30th of 93, I went to a meeting. Once again, Rich pisses me off, and I go home. Once again, I'm in bed, and I said, God, I don't know what not drinking is, but I don't want to drink no more. And I got up the next morning and went on my merry way. That was Wednesday. And at Wednesday night at the Louisville Group, 135 West Main in Louisville, Texas, on Wednesday night at 8 o'clock is a step speaker. And so I went that Wednesday night because I was going to get a white chip, and this was going to be the white chip, not another white chip. Because one time I went to go get a white chip, and I said, they said, anybody need a white chip? I go, yeah. I lost my sobriety, you know. I go saying up there, and one old timer, he goes, "You can't lose what you never had," you know. So I'm like, "Ugh." So anyway, I go Wednesday night, and it's a speaker meeting. I just felt different, you know. I just felt different, and so I was like greeting people, and here comes this guy. He's got a long, scraggly hair. He's got a sleeveless jean jacket and tats all on his arms, and he looked pretty scruffy and rough, and I hadn't seen him there, so I figured he's new, you know, and I could tell he really needed to be in a meeting, you know. I was like, "Hey, I'm Ken, you know, welcome, you know, coffee's in the back," and blah, 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 and all this stuff. He goes, "Oh, okay, thank you," you know, and I'm the official greeter now, you know. And so he's the speaker. His name was Cloaks. And so, you know, this meeting starts. Anybody want a white chip? I get up. You know, everybody's, ugh. But I didn't say anything. I just got my chip and sat down. And anyway, Clovis talked. And he shared his story. And he shared his problem with God and the religion that he grew up in and his domineering mom and all this stuff. And then he told the story that he was a couple of years sober, And he was sitting in his mom's kitchen, and she was telling him that he was going to hell because of the life he had lived. Didn't matter where he was, you know, didn't matter what he'd overcome, because he had killed four people in a head-on crash and did his time in prison. And but, you know, he was just going to go to hell. And he said, he looked at his mom and said, "Mom, how many times can I go to hell? You've been sending me to hell all my life." He said, "And I talk to God every day, and God's never told me that." I said, "I want that. That's what I want." So the next day was a Thursday, and I knew the group he went to, and I knew they had a noon meeting, so I waited until about 11:30, and I called that group, and I said, "Hey, I'm trying to get in touch with Clovis." "Oh, so-and-so's got his number," and they get somebody else on the phone, and they give me his number, and I call Clovis. I said, "Hey, this is Ken." He goes, "Oh, from the group last night, you got a white chip." I said, "Yeah." I said, "I need somebody to help me work the steps." He goes, "Well, from what I understand, you've been working them." He said, "But I got an opening, and I can show you how to apply them." And I was like, "Well, whatever, you know." So he said, "When do you want to meet?" And I said, "Well, I only work a half a day on Fridays, and that's when I usually drink the most. I said, so if we can meet on Friday, that'd be really good." He goes, "Yep, I'll put you in." He said, "Meet me at the Trinity Group, and after the noon meeting, and we'll." And so we met. And we started talking, and you know, I told him my trail of tears, woe, about how rough my life was, and how my son died, and it wasn't fair, and the woman was a bitch, and all this stuff, and you know, you'd drink too if you had my life, and all that stuff, and he just said, "You ready?" He said, "Get your spiral notebook, big book, and a 12 and 12. Meet me here next Friday." And I thought, well, I really haven't explained myself sufficiently here, you know. And so I started telling more about my pain and woe. And he said, "Ken, I can tell what your problem is." I'm like, "All right, another one, you know." He goes, "You have a fear of success." I'm like, "Yeah." He goes, "You're afraid that you're going to give yourself to this thing, and you're going to drink. It's not going to work for you." He said, "But let me tell you, don't come into this and half-ass it and go back out and drink and blame AA. He said, it's been around long enough and been tried and true. You come in and you give it all you got. And then if you drink again, then you can blame AA. But don't come in here and half-ass this thing and blame AA." He said, "Just give it all you got." I said, "All right." So we did. We met every Friday. He'd give me a reading assignment, I'd read it. He'd give me a writing assignment, I'd write it. And we kind of muddled on through. I think we were about 8 months into it. And I was already starting to make some amends. And my first amends that I made was to my ex-wife, who my son who had died's mom. And so I said, "What do I do?" He goes, "Well, you know, take God with you." You know, and I remember I drove my old pickup truck, and I had my big book sitting beside me, had a bench seat, and we made an appointment. I called her up and said, "We'll meet in neutral territory, not much people in a public place." And I was driving over there, and I was rubbing it like a magic lantern. You know, I was like, "Oh, God, be with me. Oh, God, be with me. Oh, God, be with me." And we met. Then I made amends to her, you know. I admitted my wrongs, apologized for my errors, you know, and all that stuff. And she wished me well, and she knew with the wife that I had then, I'd had another son. And he wasn't born yet when I made amends to her. Anyway. No, he was newborn. That's right. And she was newborn, and she had heard that, and she wanted to know about him and all that stuff, and we didn't really talk about it. And I tell you about making amends to her because 5 years sober, no, it was the 5-year anniversary of my first son's death, and I was, man, it was a dark, dark day in sobriety. You know, I mean, I was sober. And I had nothing to deal with the pain with, you know. I mean, it was the worst pain I'd felt at that time in sobriety. And I was at work, and I couldn't work. I couldn't focus. And you know, I told him, "Well, I got to go. He said, "Okay, go." And I'd already started going to a new group, which was the White House group. and I got a new sponsor. I went there, and he offered me some comfort, and I said, well, I got to go, and I went home. Then my wife at the time, she was said, well, won't you stay home? I said, no, I got to go to Kyle's grave. And so I go to Kyle's grave, and all the little children were buried in a certain area of the cemetery, and I drove and I parked, and I started walking to that area, and I saw, you know, you'd see people there sometimes, and I saw somebody there, and I really didn't pay any attention because I was all into me, and I walked up, and I got really close before I realized it was her. You know, it was my ex-wife, it was his mom, you know. And so it was like, oh, hey, you know, and we hugged, we cried a little bit together, and she said, you know, she'd been there a while, and she was leaving, and it was okay, and she left. And I went, you know, to the little bench they had, you know, and cried and did my thing. And then I really started to cry because I got to feel the gratitude and the power of the steps. Because if I had not made my amends to her, as soon as I realized it was her, I would have ran. So that was what I did. You know, if I fucked you over and I ran across you on the street, I would leave. You know, I would run. You know, and I didn't, you know, and that was, it was a profound moment for me, you know, and so Clovis and I were pretty tight there for a while, and I started going, then I was getting divorced from my second son's mom, and she went through the same group. It was ugly, it was bullshit, so I started looking for another group, and there was one close to my work, and it was the White House group. And there was an old man that went there that I heard about around Dallas named Searcy. And he sobered up May 10th, 1946. And he told you that every meeting. And that just what they did, you know. And he knew Bill and Bob, and he helped get Abby sober the last time Abby got sober. And, I was looking at y'all's cabinet out there with the little AA history books. Searcy had walls of books. And Searcy got to be my sponsor for a while. And Clovis showed me how to apply the steps in my life. And Searcy showed me how to apply my life to the steps. You know, because he made living out there seamlessly as with the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, and he probably, to this day, showed me one of the kindest acts that I'd ever had from another man. And it was, I found out that my second wife was, you know, cheating, money was gone, everything, it was all turning to shit real quick. Another dark moment in sobriety. You know, stay sober long enough, you'll have enough of them. But, I hadn't slept in 2 or 3 days, and it was 10 o'clock or something. I was at work, and I made up some bullshit story. I had to go somewhere, and I had to go see a vendor. So I left, and I went to the White House group because I knew Searcy would be there. And I walked in. He's a big old tall Texas guy, great big old nose, little flat nose. He went, "Champ, what are you doing here?" And I was like, "Searcy." He looked at me and goes, "Boy, you look like shit." I said, "Man, I feel worse than I look." He goes, "Come on in here." And they had a meeting room like this, and there were couches along the wall. And he said, "Go over there," and he pointed to a couch. I went over there, and he went and opened a closet, got me a blanket and a pillow. And he said, "You're safe." He said, "Nothing's going to bother you here." He said, "Have a seat, lay down, and I'll get you before the meeting starts." And I laid down, and I slept, and it was probably 10 till 12, and he came in, he nudged on me, he said, "We're going to have a meeting, and you need to stay." And I think that's what got me through the day. You know, I don't know if I would have been here with the same sobriety date if he wouldn't have been there for me. And, you know, that's happened a lot, all through my sobriety, you know, is the right people show up at the right time. You know, and I tell there's two parts of me. There's my story and there's my journey. You know, because all the time I spent my teenage years, young adult time in Stone Mountain. I don't say I grew up there because I didn't start growing up till December the 1st of 93. You know, all I was doing was getting older. You know, I mean, I acted the same at 30 years old as I acted when I was 15 years old. You know, had the same morals. I had the same lack of character. You know, I mean, I'd screw you in a heartbeat. And I didn't know what I was getting into when I got into this program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And it's never been untrue, like when my cousin asked me, is it worth it? You know, out of the dark times that I've had in sobriety, it's always been worth it when I didn't drink. You know, and that's really Rich, once again, Rich, every meeting I ever went to with him in it, he always said the same thing. The only thing you can do perfect is the first half of the first step. And I can tell you, since December the 1st of 93, that is the only step I have done perfect. The first half of the first step. I have not drank. I was a couple years sober. Went to a speaker meeting. Guy's name was Roy. Roy was getting his 20-year chip and telling his story. And he got his 20-year chip. And he said, I want y'all to know, in 20 years, it took me 20 years to do everything in sobriety that I did while I was drinking. He said, I've lied, I cheated, and I've stole in sobriety, but I didn't drink. And I remember sitting in the audience going, man, that piece of shit. You know, how can you get up there and talk that? Well, I did it in 7. So I beat him. But, and Roy said one thing when he was telling his story, and I've always used it. He said one time, he had a daughter, she was about 4, and they were watching TV, and she said, Daddy, can I sit in your lap? And he said, sure. And she got up in his lap, and they were watching the TV, and, you know, he said he was kind of holding her and, you know, patting her head, and then all of a sudden he realized she was asleep. And he said the thought came to him and goes, what a comfort that must be. To crawl up into somebody's lap and feel that safe to go right to sleep. He said, I wonder if God could do that for me. And he said when he put his daughter to bed, he went and he got into bed and he kind of, you know, curled up in the bed a little bit and he closed his eyes and he imagined that God was holding him. And ever since Roy told me that, I do that when I meditate. You know. And, you know, I got my big book, my 12 and 12. These are my original things. I got rings and stains. Some of them are beer, some of them are rum, some are bourbon, and some are coffee. And there's little rings on it, and I don't know if those are like loopholes. Because that was my big book. I had it when I was going to AA and still drinking. I had it sitting out on my work table, and I set my beer on it while I was sitting there throwing darts and crying because I was such an alcoholic, you know. And I didn't, you know, so I got me a big book right off the bat because they would say, hey, you go to a meeting, they go, you got a big book? You got a big book? So I bought a big book, and I carried it to the meeting so they quit asking me. You know, and it looked brand new. You know, the spine on the back was never broke on my big book till I started working the steps. And I've never regretted working the steps. I've got a sponsoree now, and the right people show up at the right time. I'm really glad. And I'm going to close. I'm going to read my favorite story. Is he sold himself short. But the most important story is the last story, and it's how to handle sobriety. And the most important part of that story is the last page. And it said, God willing, we members of AA may never again have to deal with drinking, but we have to deal with sobriety every day. How do we do it? By learning through practicing the 12 steps and through sharing at meetings how to cope with the problems that we look to booze to solve back in our drinking days. For example, we were told in AA that we cannot afford resentments and self-pity, so we learned to avoid these festering mental attitudes. Similarly, we rid ourselves of guilt and remorse as we clean out the garbage from our minds through the fourth and fifth steps of our recovery program. We learn how to level out the emotional swings that got us into trouble, both when we were up and when we were down. We are taught to differentiate between our wants, which are never satisfied, and our needs, which are always provided for. We cast off the burdens of the past and the anxieties of the future as we begin to live in the present one day at a time. We are granted the serenity to accept the things we cannot change and thus lose our quickness to anger and our sensitivity to criticism. Above all, we reject fantasizing and accept reality. The more I drank, the more I fantasized everything. I imagined getting even for hurts and rejections. In my mind's eye, I played and replayed scenes in which I was plucked magically from the bar where I stood nursing a drink and was instantly exalted to some position of power and prestige. I live in a dream world. AA led me gently from this fantasizing to embrace reality with open arms, and I found it beautiful, for at last I was at peace with myself and with others and with God. My son now is 23 years old, and I raised him.
His mom went
off. I don't know what it is with me and women, man. They're really fine when I first meet them, and then after a while, they're crazy. They're not too bad. You're the exception. But anyway, I raised my son. He never saw me drink. He never saw me doing drugs, but he sure saw me crazy. But he saw that I had option to go where and when things got real crazy. And, he told me not too long ago, one of his touching moments. He said, "Dad, I sure am glad you go to AA." I said, "Yeah, me too." And so I don't know how long y'all been sober or why you come to AA. But, don't trash AA if you're not working the steps to the best of your ability. You got nothing to lose because it's right out there. Whatever you left out there is still out there. You can always go right back to it. But at least give this a chance because not everybody gets another chance at sobriety. Stay sober long enough and you'll stand at enough graves. The biggest one that I saw, his name was Ben. He was 24. He came into AA and he got 2 years. And he was a real friendly guy. And he went to a lot of meetings and something happened, and he kind of quit going, and he came to a meeting. He said, "I just don't want to be sober no more." And everybody tried, "No, man, come on." He goes, "No, I don't." And they said, "I've thought about it. I don't want to be sober no more." And he lived in a loft apartment at a guy I know's house, and nobody saw him for a couple of days or heard from him. So Stan went up to go check on him, and he opened the door, and Ben was sitting bloated at his kitchen table. Bunch of crushed up oxy and a half bottle of whiskey sitting on the table. He had OD'd. It only took him 2 weeks after sobriety to do that. So this might be your only chance at sobriety, so please stay. That's all I got.
Thank you, Ken. As a good friend of mine would say, that's a good AA talk. Thanks from George, too.
Blotting out blindness.
signs. What's the use in hiding now? Stop to realize. Stop the big debate. Stop the criticize. Love has got the power. There's nothing more you need inside.
Love will carry the weight.